See to the third case of the day. Apple versus Walmart.
Okay, please the court. This is a case where a lady was given by Walmart a drug that they knew she was allergic to. And as a result of that drug, she went and had an anaphylactic reaction. The issue in this, one of the issues in our appeal, is whether the trial court properly barred the testimony of a highly experienced neuro-ophthalmologist, a neurologist, and a second neurologist, that physical and emotional stress can and does exacerbate multiple sclerosis. We are seeking a new trial because of that error, as well as the jury instruction, which did not separate the damages of both Mr. and Mrs. Happel as a result of this occurrence.
Was a verdict form submitted that broke down the amounts by plaintiffs?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
And that verdict form was rejected. The court just did the total amount.
Yes, correct. And over our objection, and in fact, I believe it wasn't even objected to our verdict form by the defendant. This was a sua sponte decision made by the trial court. We believe that was made it impossible for the jury, of course, to give an itemized verdict as is required because both of Kent and Heidi's causes of action are separate, and they had independent damages.
Well, what kind of prejudice was there to them by having that joint verdict form? Because, as I understand, tenancy here in Illinois, tenancy by the entirety may no longer exist, but weren't the damages that they received still shared as marital property?
No, actually, their damages are separate, and their award from their damages are separate. As we noted, husband can sue a wife and vice versa. The demonstration of that harm, that is to say the jury was instructed that these are separate causes of action and they should determine their damages separately and then not given the opportunity to do that. And an example of one of the examples of that harm is that there was a prior settlement with the prescribing physician where $75,000 of it went to Heidi and $75,000 of it went to Kent. And if the jury, it may very well be that the jury awarded, when they awarded their $465,400, I think it could have been $465,000 to Heidi and $400 to Kent, making the set off considerably different. In other words, there would be only $75,000 minus $400 as a set-off to Kent in that circumstance.
That set-off was not appealed, right?
That's correct. The underlying issues, I think, are far of greater importance, Your Honor. We believe that the judge did not apply the proper standards in determining whether or not the testimony of Dr. Hirsch and Dr. Bringwald.
Before you move on to the experts, I just have one additional question about this verdict form. Did you have notice during an instructions conference, either on or off the record, that the judge was rejecting the special verdict form and using a general verdict form on damage?
Yes, he rejected it. And we argued it.
Okay, so that's on the record. He said, no, I'm not giving your instruction. I'm giving a general verdict form.
Yes.
Okay.
Move on.
I didn't know if that came as a surprise.
Well, it was a surprise to me when it wasn't objected to by the defendants, and the court just rejected ours and said, I'm going to give a general one.
But you did have notice of that before the jury was instructed and went out for deliberations. Okay.
Yes.
What's the prejudice that you... You allege it in a brief, but you don't really spell it out, Doctor.
These are a husband and wife. They have separate damages. They may divorce. They can choose to have separate accounts. They can their own economic interests can be unified, but it can be separate. And it's not up to the defendant, in this case, Walmart, to make that choice. This is their choice. The two damages are, one, each of them are deprived of their own settlement so that they may very well choose to put their funds in separate accounts. And who knows, you know, there's a lot of stress in this marriage, as one can imagine. Within 6 weeks of Kent marrying Heidi, she was injured by this Toradol and her multiple sclerosis, which had been quiescent and minimal for 3 years and even minimal purely optic neuritis for years prior to that.
It's a potential prejudice that you fear.
No, it's real. Oh, no. They are entitled to, if they choose, to put their funds in separate accounts and keep them separately. This is not marital property. They're entitled to have it separate, as would any husband and wife. This is
Is that the history of this couple?
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Is that the history of this couple?
No, that is not. This is a loving, devoted husband to an injured wife. But they have.
Well, I mean, you can have separate accounts and still be loving, I guess.
Yes. Well, you know, Your Honor, you make a good point that I don't really know the answer whether they have separate accounts, to be honest with you. You make a very good point on that. But in addition, there's also the very real injury as to the set-off. If the jury were to have awarded, as I indicated, that was the reason we set it off that way, so that we could get that benefit, and that we were deprived of that by the court's ruling. And there's no law in Illinois that which permits a joint verdict form for two separate causes of action of two separate individuals, and we cited some of it's old but still applicable case law.
Now, Illinois law creates a rebuttable presumption that all property acquired after marriage is marital property. You agree with that proposition?
You know, I can't answer that question, Your Honor. I'm afraid that would be outside of my knowledge base.
And marital property can include personal injury awards.
It can, yes. Whether they choose to do that, I know they have the absolute right to, and they would receive separate checks, just as they did at the first settlement. So that whether they were choose to combine it or not, that's entirely up to them. Going on to the second issue, and that is the judge did not use the proper standard in determining whether the testimony that MS is exacerbated by physical and emotional stress. There was no evidence presented to the judge by any defense witness that indicated that this causation issue was not accepted in the medical community. The judge rejected or did not understand or perhaps was confused by the research that was done for this. Dr. Bringwald has treated 5,000 patients with MS. He went through, at page 20 of his deposition, Exhibit 52, the specific methodology that he uses. Empiric research, asking questions and acting and seeing the results of actions, is empiric research, which is the cornerstone of medical research. Judge Moran felt that there should be some kind of study which exposes patients to such an event to see whether or not this kind of... Now, remember, this lady went into anaphylaxis. She was hypoxic, suffered brain damage, and was hospitalized in an intensive care unit. Her symptoms developed within days of her being discharged from the hospital, symptoms of her exacerbation of her MS. Dr. Bringwald, at page 20, indicated that this is he takes a detailed history from his patients routinely, 5,000 patients. There can be no question about his qualifications as an expert. There can also be and should have been no question about his methodology, because the methodology of taking a history from patients and seeing the effects of events or actions or stimuli and the results of those is a standard part of medical research. And there was no testimony to the contrary, and I think that's very important. The judge supplanted medical testimony and medical methodology with his own understanding. And that is, I believe, an error. It seems that we have the burden of proof. Once we presented the proof that this was an accepted methodology, and I think the quotation, if I have it, is that this is, he routinely asked patients whether stress, psychological or physical, preceded symptoms of MS, and frequently that's the case, and that's something that's recognized by a lot of physicians who see these problems. What that is medicalese, for this is a generally accepted observation and concept in medicine.
And counsel, these opinions went to the scope of the recoverable damages here because liability was stipulated to, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. This was a case where, this is a case where they admitted finally negligence and they admitted that some injuries were caused. It was clearly the extent of the injuries and specifically whether or not the MS was exacerbated by the negligence of the defendant. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Dr. Chesson. Mr. Bone.
May it please the court, counsel. I think a few points of clarification are necessary at the outset here. There was some discussion with regard to the jury verdict form as to the set-off order. Prior to briefing, there was a request by the court to address the jurisdiction. And in that request, it was specifically noted that in the notice of appeal, only the May 11th order was mentioned. The March 23rd order, which discusses the set-off, was not mentioned. Because of that, plaintiffs admitted that the set-off order was not on appeal, and then the court does not have jurisdiction over that order according to Rule 3. Thus, I would argue that what plaintiffs are doing in discussing the set-off order is trying to do a runaround jurisdiction, and I think that's improper. And a discussion of that set-off order should be ignored.
I'm not so sure about that. Just because they don't challenge your right to a set-off and the amount of the set-off, what was it, $150,000, doesn't mean they can't argue the set-off issue as the prejudice that was suffered by the error in using a general damages verdict here, which it seems to me was clearly an error. Maybe you'd like to address that.
Which was clearly an error, I'm sorry.
Submitting this case to the jury on a general damages verdict when there were multiple items of damages, separate items of damages that should have been itemized, and in particular a separate claim for loss of consortium by the husband, and the application of the set-off was going to be impacted by that.
Well, I think when we first address what was necessary in that verdict form, I think to determine whether there was an abuse of discretion, you have to determine whether there was some prejudice. And in order to do that, I think you look at whether the jury was confused. Now, what did the jury receive? The jury received very specific instructions as to what damages were available in this case. There were seven categories that were pointed out by Judge Moran in those instructions, and they discussed that loss of consortium.
Right. I don't think there was anything wrong with the instructions, and the argument isn't that the instruction on damages was wrong. The argument is that the submission of the case to the jury on a single-line damages verdict was an abuse of discretion because of the separate items of damages that were being claimed here, and in particular because of the separate claim for loss of consortium by the husband, which was going to make a difference in how the set-off was applied. If the jury awarded the husband $50,000 and the balance of the $400,000 went to the wife for her various claims, pain and suffering, lost wages, and all the other categories of damages that were awarded to her, then the set-off would have applied differently. apparently, at least that's what we're being told by the plaintiff's counsel, because the prior settlement was $75,000 to the husband and $75,000 to the wife.
That is true.
Right. So that's a form of tangible prejudice, is it not? I mean, it would be getting, if that scenario is actually how the jury considered these separate damages claims, then they would be entitled to $25,000 more.
Obviously, I think we have a disagreement as to whether or not that set-off order is at issue. I argue that it is not within the jurisdiction of the court to address, and I understand you're saying that that's incorrect. So addressing
your
question.
I think you've got to answer my question, counsel.
Yes, addressing your question of whether there was an abuse of discretion in light of the set-off being for $75,000 a plaintiff and the general verdict form.
You can see that
is
a form of prejudice.
There is a problem if it is an issue. I guess what I would suggest that the court could conceivably do is issue an order that, because you can't tell whether the set-off, whether the general verdict, how much money went to each spouse, then maybe the set-off should be revisited and that only $75,000 could be awarded. Because if you look at what occurred, I mean, some party had to receive more than $75,000. And if that's the case, then a set-off of $75,000 would be justified. Maybe you could argue that there was, just looking at it mathematically, it's hard to determine where the $150,000
well,
could be set.
I think that's something that the two of you can achieve by way of a settlement on remand, but it sounds to me like you're conceding that there was an error and that there was prejudice because of the set-off.
If there was any error, Your Honor, I think the error might have been with regard to the March 23 order. But, again, that's not what has been appealed by
the set-off order. The error is the submission of the case to the jury on a single-line item damages verdict so that we don't know how the jury sliced and diced the damages.
As to whether it is just per se error for providing a general verdict form when there are many different facets of damages.
This is highly unusual, isn't it? I mean, both of you stipulated to a special verdict and individual questions on the separate line items of damages that were being claimed here.
That's correct, Your Honor. And Judge Moran decided to go with a simple one-line damages provision because negligence was admitted in this matter, and evidently he felt that based upon the instructions, the jury could consider all the damages at issue and issue a single damages amount.
And you didn't speak up and say, Judge, we want it itemized?
We did not, time, Your Honor.
The plaintiff objected, apparently.
Plaintiff did object.
I mean, and besides this whole set-off issue, when you look at the various breakdown of damages, like, say, the reasonableness, expense, and medical care, treatment, services, you know, what if the jury put a zero in there? And I assume there was some evidence submitted on what those damages were. So one of the things we would do is review. I mean, the plaintiff would have an opportunity to try to move to set aside the verdict if the jury ignored valid evidence. And, of course, under this scenario, he can't attack any of the findings that the jury made because the jury didn't make any finding. Right? In other words,
it's not clear from that verdict form.
Well, no, it's not. Well, not clear. It's just not there because it's one big pot. So I'm just saying you could look at each of these, but specifically that's something that's very finite and very definite, you know, what medical expenses are. If the jury put in a big fat zero, I mean, there's no way. I mean, you would square that evidence with the jury putting a zero in the box, so that's a problem as well, isn't it?
There's certainly no way to verify what medical expense damages were awarded by the jury.
Or value of salaries and benefits lost. We don't know what that is.
One lump sum is admitted. There isn't any clear, as the parties discussed in the brief, there isn't any clear precedent for this kind of situation in the circuit. I don't believe that the cases that were relied upon by the plaintiffs are binding. in that Catton versus Flig case, it was actually the defendant that was objecting to the general verdict form and not the plaintiffs that received a verdict in that case. So I don't think that that is applicable. The two cases that defendant was able to provide the court, first district cases, talk about the use of minimalist verdict forms, and there wasn't an abuse of discretion found in those instances. So I would argue that the court should follow that lead in addressing the issue here on the verdict form. With regard to the expert opinions, it's surprising to me that plaintiffs continue to disregard Judge Moran's order as to Dr. Bringewald. That order was that Dr. Bringewald's expert opinion was barred because of failure to disclose it according to Rule 26. That the bar is that Rule 26 disclosures are mandatory, and in light of that, I don't see how Judge Moran's order could be an abuse of discretion. Plaintiffs also discuss Dr. Hirsch in a very minimal way. I think the Daubers and Rule 702 applications are the same as to both of those experts. In this instance, there were no peer review was conducted, no publications were provided that supported the notion that physical or emotional stress exacerbate MS. Indeed, the defendant brought forward a publication that indicated quite the opposite and did discuss how studies and tests were performed, and those studies supported the opposite of what Dr. Bringewald and Dr. Hirsch were trying to opine to. There are no further questions. I'll rest on the arguments in the briefs.
Thank you, sir. Yes, sir.
The court's ruling regarding barring the testimony of Dr. Hirsch and Dr. Bringewald was an interlocutory order, as would any order be regarding trial witnesses. The court obviously overruled that order when he did, in fact, permit both Dr. Hirsch and Dr. Bringewald to testify and testify in their entirety, except for the one specific area that we are appealing on this issue, and that's the relationship between physical stress causing MS. I stress again that the defense provided no medical evidence. Even the article that they provided did not have any foundation. They had no one to indicate that this is an authoritative article. It is reliable. The court was left on his own regarding any way to dispute any of the testimony of the plaintiff's experts. Dr. Bringewald was obviously unquestionably qualified. His methodology was sound. He indicated that this was a opinion that is held by many physicians, a lot of physicians who deal with this type of problem. I think I'm quoting him pretty closely. And that he's indicated that MS is exacerbated by physical and emotional stress. And this was a huge stress this lady underwent, Your Honors. Dr. Hirsch, the court's ruling on limiting his testimony was that he wasn't qualified. And I would suggest to the court that that's improper and that's an abuse of discretion. That goes to the weight of his testimony, not his admissibility. He's a board-certified neurologist in active practice. He's a professor of neurology at Western Medical School, and he's got a active practice. Any suggestion that he wasn't qualified, and that's what the court's ruling was on that, could only go to his the weight of his testimony and not to his admissibility. I believe that the court, while he didn't articulate it, I believe that, you know, he was ruling on the same basis that he was barring the testimony, not only of Dr. Bringewald, but also of Dr. Schwertfeger, who also testified in his deposition that stress exacerbates MS, but was not permitted to testify to that at the trial. All of that, I believe, Your Honor, was abuses of discretion. If I can go to the verdict form for just one moment, I know that a perfect example is if the jury found a dollar for Kent and the remainder of the verdict for Heidi, the deduction would be $75,000 and therefore $380,400 as compared with $315,400. The difference that would go to Heidi, so that the harm, and of course the court's ruling regarding the setoff would have to be error, and we didn't bring that up as error if there was error on the verdict form. There's no way to reconcile those. I'd only close by saying that for reasons that I do not understand, the court did not recognize the classic value of empirical research in medicine, that case reports are part of every journal. It's part of the way medical research has been done. There's reports to drug companies that are included in PDRs. Case reports, and particularly with somebody like Dr. Bringwell, who's got 5,000 patients that he's been following with this, that's highly relevant, and it was unrefuted. No one came in here and said that this was not a commonly accepted theory of causation in medicine.
Thank you. All right, our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.